WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. I'm Steve Bonta, and I'm substituting today for Paul Dragoo, my very able colleague who's still out of the office on assignment, but he will be back tomorrow. In today's lead story, the shameless political persecution of Donald Trump and his supporters continued on Monday with the announcement by Washington, D.C. Judge Tanya Chutkan that Trump's federal trial will commence on Monday, March 4th, exactly one day before Super Tuesday, the day that 15 states hold their Republican primary election or caucus to vote for presidential candidates. Sure, there's no coincidence there. Judge Chutkan, an Obama campaign donor and Obama appointee to the United States District Court, has a long and consistent record of supporting leftist causes, such as forcing the Trump administration's Office of Refugee Resettlement to allow minors in their custody to have abortions. Also, opposition to the Trump administration's Department of Justice lethal injection procedure, and also ruling against Trump's Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, for allegedly delaying the implementation of regulations regarding racial disparities among school children. Kind of a common theme there. Chutkan is also known for being the toughest judge for J6 defendants, having presided over more than 30 trials and frequently handing down sentences far tougher than even those recommended by the prosecution. In other words, Chutkan has been one of Donald Trump's most consistent legal foes, and she has already gone on record expressing her belief that Trump deserves to be brought to justice. Hardly an impartial judge. In a 2022 sentencing hearing for an Ohio woman who pled guilty to obstructing Congress's certification of Biden's so-called victory, Chutkan said, quote, "The people who mobbed that Capitol were there in fealty and loyalty to one man, not to the Constitution, of which most of the people who come before me seem woefully ignorant, not to the ideals of this country, and not to the principles of democracy. It's a blind loyalty to one person who, by the way, remains free to this day." Unquote. By the way, the woman sentenced by Chutkan on that occasion, an occupational therapist for the Cleveland schools named Christine Priola, whose offense was to carry a sign into the Capitol and take cell phone videos, as seen here, received 15 months of prison plus a year of supervised release and a $2,000 fine from Judge Chutkan, despite apologizing profusely to the court and having no criminal record. And now this same radical left hanging judge has made sure to set Trump's trial in the thick of next year's electoral campaign and is completely unmoved by calls from Trump's defense team to move the trial back or recuse herself from the case. Given the very limited time to prepare for the case, Trump lawyer John Lauro told the judge yesterday that while they would respect the latest ruling, they would not be able to give Trump, quote, adequate representation, unquote. And that, of course, is exactly what Judge Chutkan, Prosecutor Jack Smith, and the entire thuggish crew of Biden administration officials, including the president himself, are hoping. Well, with me today is Bill Hahn, CEO of the John Birch Society, our parent organization. Bill, the brazen and unprecedented nature of this campaign against a political rival shows just how perilous our situation has become, legally speaking. The radical left appears to be in firm control of the entire machinery of so-called justice, and they're executing a coordinated attempt to destroy Trump and his movement, and seemingly don't care what the people think or what the laws dictate. So is this evidence, do you think, that our republic is in its death throes?
In the death throes?
Yeah.
Now, there's a loaded question, Steve. Well, if I may, I'm forever an optimist. I operate on humor. So let me just add a little levity to this entire situation. You a John Wayne fan?
Absolutely.
All right. So there's a 1971 movie that he starred in called Big Jake.
Jake McCandless. Yep.
Yes.
Sure.
Yeah. Jacob McCandless. Right. Mm-hmm. So as John Wayne says to Richard Boone, the bad guy, when he walked into the area that he's covered, Richard Boone is basically telling him, you know, we've got a rifle on you from here, we got a pistol on you from here.
I remember the scene. Right. Great scene. Yep.
And John Wayne gets the smile. He knows he's outnumbered, outgunned. He gets a smile on his face, and he looks at him point blank, you know, deadpan in his eyes. And he says, "You must figure I'm a real dangerous man."
Yeah.
All right. Well, big Donald Trump, they must figure that he's a real dangerous man. But yet, he is not just one person. it is somebody that obviously that they are persecuting. But if you think of it this way, not is he just standing up for himself, but he's also representing those patriotic Americans who dare stand up against the deep state and its globalist conspiracy.
Well, realistically, do you think Trump has a chance? By the way, what you just said has internet meme written all over it. We should get our video guys on that. You know, superimpose Trump's face on John.
Absolutely. Like yeah.
But
yeah.
But do you think that we that Trump stands a chance against these people? I mean, it's not just obviously the federal indictment, but there are now three state level indictments, all coordinated now. And the latest news since we prepared the script for today's show is that the Fulton County people and everyone else may want to all put Trump on trial at the exact same time in March, so that he literally can't do any campaigning. He will literally be in the courtroom, you know, shuttling back and forth from one thing to another
sure.
for who knows how many weeks or months.
Yeah.
Does he have a chance of overcoming so much opposition?
Well, that's one thing about Trump. He's always in campaign mode. He has been, you know, for quite some time. And what happens when he doesn't show up to a debate? I mean, look at the poll numbers. So he was up 40 points to his closest rival, DeSantis, and his absence at the week before's debate had nothing, didn't do any detriment to him, okay? But yet DeSantis' numbers, he's at 13%, and Trump is, as I wrote down here, 52%.
Right.
Okay. So, from a campaign perspective, I mean, all of this indictment and persecution can only help him.
Okay, but thinking ahead,
so
and this is kind of my last question. This has been bothering. So what happens if Trump gets convicted mm-hmm. and jailed and gets elected president anyway? I mean, don't we foresee a potential, epical, real constitutional crisis, the likes of which we haven't seen since the Civil War? So I don't see the left backing down on this.
Sure. Well, and it's interesting too, because if you this is why elections are important. You know, Trump got in so many of the federal judges, and others throughout the jurisprudence, and obviously so has Biden. Now look at who these folks have been picking, as far as getting these cases, in certain areas that are picked up predominantly by these radical leftists, judges, and looking ahead, so you won't find those in every single position out there as far as judgeship goes, right? So at some point, I'm starting to wonder, to be honest with you. At some point, this is going to get bumped up even higher to the U.S. Supreme Court, and perhaps there will be some sort of justice. But nonetheless, Trump is going to use this to his advantage. And could there be a possibility that 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue will be switched for some sort of a jail cell in which he's going to be governing from a phone and from Truth Social? Perhaps.
It's hard to imagine. I guess we'll see. That obviously an ongoing story. We're going to give continue coverage of this these unprecedented events. But let's turn to the Biden corruption scandal. So, former Ukrainian prosecutor Viktor Shokin, who was famously fired by the Ukrainian government in 2016 for investigating corruption at Burisma, which is the big Ukrainian gas company, including its relationship with the Biden family, appeared on Fox's One Nation with Brian Kilmeade over the weekend. And for the first time, Shokin gave his side of the story. Let's listen a bit.
Why were you fired from your position by President Poroshenko?
I have said repeatedly in my previous interviews that Poroshenko fired me at the insistence of the then Vice President Biden because I was investigating Burisma.
So did President Poroshenko tell you that he wanted you to stay on the job, but there was pressure from Vice President Biden?
You understood me correctly. This is how it was. There were no complaints whatsoever, no problems with how I was performing at my job. But because pressure was repeatedly put on President Poroshenko, that is what ended up in him firing me.
They were up to no good. Were they up to doing something corrupt with Burisma? Was the company of Burisma corrupt, as been alleged, in which since has been disbanded?
I have no doubt that there were illegal activities engaged in by Burisma. As a matter of fact, the criminal case had been started before me. It continued to expand. And Zlochevsky, who at the time held the post of minister and was the founder and CEO of Burisma, started bringing in people who could provide protection for him. Hunter Biden was among them. And the corruption network expanded as a result. Because he understood, and so did Vice President Biden, that had I continued to oversee the Burisma investigation, we would have found the facts about the corrupt activities that they were engaging in that included both Hunter Biden and Devin Archer and others.
Wow. Well, Shokin apparently also told Kilmeade off camera that he would be more than happy to come and testify before Congress regarding this whole matter if needed. So again, Shokin, you may recall, was the guy that then Vice President Biden actually boasted about getting fired by threatening to withhold foreign aid in the form of $1 billion of loan guarantees from the United States to the Ukrainian government. So here's Biden, for those of you who may have forgotten, sharing the details with a sympathetic audience of globalists at the Council on Foreign Relations.
I remember going over convincing our team, or others, to convincing us that we should be providing for loan guarantees. And I went over, I guess, the 12th, 13th time to Kyiv, and I was supposed to announce that there was another $1 billion loan guarantee. And I had gotten a commitment from Poroshenko and from Yatsenyuk that they would take action against the state prosecutor, and they didn't. So they said they were walking out to press conference. Said, "No," I said, "I'm not going to. We're not going to give you the $1 billion." They said, "You have no authority. You're not the president." The president said, "I said, call him." I said, "I'm telling you, you're not getting the $1 billion." I said, "You're not getting the billion. I'm going to be leaving here." And I think it was what, 6 hours. I looked. I said, "I'm leaving in 6 hours. If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money." Well, son of a bitch, got fired, and they put in place someone who was solid.
So this was also the matter that President Donald Trump sought answers to in his infamous phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky, and for which he was promptly impeached by the Democrats. Bill, this seems to be just another example of the left doing what it always, you know, what it always falsely accuses its enemies of doing. So they impeached Donald Trump over a single phone call, you know, the infamous perfect phone call, in which he tried to get to the truth of what is now clearly an example of base corruption and bribery on the part of Joe Biden and his extended family and all of his political cronies. Biden learned that Shokin was getting too close to his involvement with Burisma, so he had him removed from the picture. Do you think there'll ever be justice for these actions?
Well, think of it from a standpoint of impeachment, right? I mean, there's all of this that's being bantered around, you know, Washington D.C. In regards to you know, whether or not there will be justice, you know, for that. Unfortunately, this has been, you know, the way that it's been in Washington for decades, right? There's always been that corruption. And the way to combat that, obviously, is to hold government accountable. And one constitutional tool to do that is through impeachment. Now, the John Birch Society has been integral in at least two educational campaigns that were flown under the banner of impeachment. The first is Impeach Earl Warren, who was Chief Justice, right, that had basically legislated from the bench, and supported whole hog the leftist indoctrination at that point of the American people, and then of course and you saw our billboards all across the country with that Impeach Earl Warren. You know, Mr. Welch did a fantastic job with that publicity campaign, and then the second was the Impeach Bill Clinton.
Which did come to fruition.
Which did come to fruition, exactly. And what we, but, and that was based off of Chinagate, and not so much his actions that he had, you know, with a White House intern. unfortunately, in it. And that was, you know, all turned around. So there were mountains of resources and work that went into, you know, both of those educational campaigns, of which, you know, as you point out, there was some fruition, actually on both accounts, from an educational standpoint. And that's what really helps to invigorate, you know, we the people, which is what the founding fathers expected, you know, the citizens or patriots of this country to step forward and, you know, be active in the accountability process.
Well, it is certainly looking like Biden may end up getting impeached, certainly from what we're seeing. Whether that will result in his removal from office is an entirely different question.
Well, exactly, because when you look at the Constitution, you know, we look at Article 1, Section 5, and it says here, the Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. And well, when we look at the numbers now, you know, we are, excuse me, Section 3. You look at the numbers now and they're not there. I mean, do we expect Democrats to, you know, go across the aisle and actually support, you know, this type of impeachment?
Well, I guess we'll see. We'll see what happens as things go on. Hey, folks, time is running out to get your tickets to the John Birch Society's Leadership Conference this September. This year, we're holding the event in Des Moines, Iowa. We'll be going over strategies you can use to restore our nation, and we'll bring plenty of materials you can take back home with you. This will also be a great opportunity for us to meet you and for you to meet other patriots working to restore our wonderful nation. Our keynote speaker will be Dr. Ryan Cole, whose discussion topic will be The Death of Science, Medical Freedom in an Era of Lies. James Patrick, the film director of the movie Nitrogen 2000, will also be speaking. On Friday, we're going to do dinner and watch his movie. Former U.S. Congressman Steve King will join us as well, as will renowned physicist and election expert Dr. Douglas Frank. The New American's Alex Newman will be there to talk about how climate change is used to scare and control people. And that's just a sample of everything that's happening over those 2 days. Bill and I will both be there, by the way. You can learn more and get your conference tickets at jbs.org. If you prefer, you can call 1-800-527-8721 for tickets. Again, get your tickets at jbs.org or call 1-800-527-8721. Now stay tuned because we'll be right back with more Truth Behind the News.
Freedom is the cure.
You're dead on. This is the largest experiment performed on human beings in the history of the world.
The more you know.
What they're doing is they're forcing vaccination on people, and I believe they are killing people with this vaccination.
The freer you are.
It's murder. They are basically murdering people in hospitals.
The all-cause mortality, we know, is now higher in the vaccinated group than the unvaccinated group.
Stay informed on the issues that affect freedom. Get a subscription to The New American today, thenewamerican.com.
Welcome back. In this segment, we're going to take a look at the so-called C40 plan to ban meat and dairy products, as well as all private vehicles in 14 American cities, as well as in other cities. But first, a quick rundown of international news, some of which we've covered in past editions of this show. In Russia, the government has announced that DNA testing of human remains from last week's jet crash north of Moscow has confirmed leader of the June Wagner Group uprising, Yevgeny Prigozhin, was one of the deceased. In Niger, in West Africa, where leftist pro-France President Mohamed Bazoum was overthrown last week in a military coup, the French ambassador to the country, Sylvain Ité, is refusing to leave despite being given 48 hours to depart the country. Ambassador Ité has also refused to meet with the new military rulers, and it bears mentioning that U.S. troops are still in that country. So we'll see how that turns out. Now, in India, India's Chandrayaan-3 lunar lander, which made a successful landing last week at the moon's south pole and made India only the fourth country to achieve a lunar landing, has begun taking pictures of the unexplored region of the lunar surface and has taken its first ever temperature reading at the moon's south pole. And in Taiwan, billionaire Foxconn founder Terry Goh has announced he will run for the Taiwan presidency, vowing to repair relations with mainland China and prevent Taiwan from becoming the next Ukraine. Well, now back to the USA, where 14 American cities plan to ban meat and dairy products, as well as all private vehicles, even electric vehicles, within the next 7 years. The cities are part of a group known as C40, a self-described global network of nearly 100 mayors of the world's leading cities that are united in action to confront the climate crisis. Here are the U.S. cities that are part of C40: Boston, New York City, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Miami, Chicago, New Orleans, Houston, and Austin in Texas, Phoenix, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, and Seattle. Mayors of dozens of other cities across the globe are also members. They have signed on to a C40 agreement called The Future of Urban Consumption in a 1.5 degree Celsius World, which admits to ambitious targets for the year 2030. Among these are no meat and dairy consumption for residents of these cities and no private vehicles. But that's not all. Here's Jordan Peterson describing the C40 big picture.
The C40 is the consortium of municipalities that have signed on to the 15-minute city plan. And I read in their own documentation, this is relevant to the tri-state city idea, that their goals are to reduce caloric consumption to 2,500 calories a day by force, essentially, within the next 15 years, to ensure that the peasant class, which is everybody but the elitists, can't fly more than one time every 3 years, to not merely shift private car ownership from fossil fuel to electric, which is fundamentally impossible because the grid can't handle it, but to eliminate 90% of private car ownership so that people are forced to take, you know, unbelievably expensive in terms of time utilization and non-existent public transportation systems, and to limit the amount of travel that people can do outside of their neighborhoods.
Well, other ambitious targets, quote-unquote, mentioned in the C40 document include limiting each resident to 3 new items of clothing per year and reducing the use of raw materials employed in construction and infrastructure by 20 to 90%. The report says that last goal would not be limited to C40 cities alone, but would apply, quote, across their host country, unquote. The current C40 chair is a textbook globalist, Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London and former chair of the ultra-left Fabian Society. Here he is, virtue signaling about C40's tyrannical plans.
I'm incredibly proud and honored to be elected global chair of C40, the network of major cities around the world committed to addressing the climate emergency. C40 leaders represent over 700 million people worldwide and a quarter of the global economy. At this critical time for our planet, I'm determined to use London's leadership of the C40 global movement to inspire and accelerate the climate action that's desperately needed.
C40 chairmanship is a rotating position, and one of its past presidents is New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who, according to Vanity Fair, has 8 big and expensive homes in the state of New York, as well as part-time residences in Florida, Colorado, Bermuda, and London. So he'll be able to get out of New York anytime he wants, if he feels like eating meat or dairy products. He also owns a fleet of private, carbon dioxide-spewing airplanes and helicopters, and several cars, including a high-performance Audi R8 sports car and a Chevy Suburban SUV. Yet during a recent Bloomberg New Economy Forum, he gave advice on how the rest of us can decrease our so-called carbon footprints. He also complained that there is not enough urgency in dealing with what he describes as a climate crisis.
Climate change starts in the cities because that's where we use energy. If you could reduce the amount of energy used in the city, for example, turn off your air conditioner when you leave home. Don't let it run all day. You use less energy. There's no secrets here about how you reduce consumption. The only thing is, do you have the willingness to reduce greenhouse gases? There's certainly not enough sense of urgency in dealing with the problem that the world is warming. And every year it gets worse.
As for the goals outlined in the Future of Urban Consumption document, fact-checkers quote a deflecting statement as solid proof that this in no way means anyone will make you stop eating meat or having a personal vehicle. The statement reads, quote, "This report does not advocate for the wholesale adoption of these more ambitious targets in C40 cities. Rather, they are included to provide a set of reference points that cities and other actors can reflect on when considering different emission reduction alternatives and long-term urban visions," unquote. Despite this facade of innocence, some cities have already taken steps toward a not-too-distant dystopia. According to The Federalist, this year, New York Mayor Eric Adams announced that the city will place caps on the amount of meat and dairy served by state institutions such as schools and prisons. Meanwhile, the UK has banned the sale of new gas-powered vehicles after 2030, and France has banned short-haul flights to cut carbon emissions, unquote. Also, California Governor Gavin Newsom is planning to ban all gas-powered vehicles in his state by 2035. And none other than Klaus Schwab's World Economic Forum is a major promoter of the C40 Cities Climate Leadership Group. That's the same World Economic Forum that back in 2017 made 8 predictions for the world in 2030, the first of which is, you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. But it gets worse. The fourth prediction blatantly says, you'll eat much less meat, an occasional treat, not a staple, for the good of the environment and health. And number 6 forecasts a global tax on carbon to help make fossil fuels history. Well, Bill, do you think the American people ever buy into this? Is this going to fly here? And if not, what's going to happen? The elites seem determined to push this forward at any cost.
Yeah. You know, the problem, obviously, is that we are in a battle. And when one side doesn't show up, the other side steamrolls. Okay? This has been going on for decades. I mean, so it was obviously it was the New American that broke the story in, I think it was 1992, of having you know, investigative reporter at the Rio summit that exposed their Agenda 21, which is now, in addition to Agenda 21, Agenda 2030, which has all of the sustainable developmental goals that the United Nations wants to, you know, enslave the world with. And it's the same thing that we saw with the Agenda 21 battle. The whole argument is that, you know, this is soft, or this is non-binding, right? Non-binding, as they called it. You can check Agenda 21 Wikipedia entry and see that. As well as them calling the John Birch Society conspiratorialists.
Yeah, the whole thing seems so ludicrous. I mean, I remember in 92, and Bill Jasper was the guy that went to Rio and got that great coverage back then.
That's right.
And we've been very consistently covering all of these, you know, succeeding climate protocols and everything else. Yeah. And what we've seen is precisely what we warned about, namely that this soft power would sure steadily evolve into hard power. And now we've got a radical administration that's determined to implement the Paris Accord and all the rest of this, Agenda 2030.
Yep.
And, you know, they're hell-bent to achieve this at any cost. Their goal seems to be nothing less than the destruction of modern technological industrial civilization, except for themselves, of course. Yeah. And they're making no apologies about it.
Well, and look what they've done. So they understand, you know, that in order to have, you know, the federal power is through Congress, right, through the House, and they have ignored that to a certain degree. I mean, they've got some buy-in there, but in order to get some long-term traction going, they went directly to the cities. And again, Agenda 20, exactly the same thing that they did with Agenda 21, and we stopped that back then. We need to do so today.
Hope so. See what happens. Well, that's all for our news segment today, folks. For more truth behind the news, make sure to get a subscription to the New American Magazine. You can do so online at thenewamerican.com or by calling our office at 800-727-8783 Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. And stay tuned, because we'll be right back with more New American TV.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.
Next up, in Conversations That Matter, Alex Newman interviews Moises Esteves, the Executive Vice President of Child Evangelism Fellowship, or CEF. The CEF is actively fighting to put good news clubs in public schools to teach children about the Bible, prayer, and Christianity. But those clubs are threatened with expulsion when Satanist clubs weasel their way into the schools and scare tactics are used to get both the Christian and Satanist clubs thrown out. You'll not want to miss this interview.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Conversations That Matter. I'm your host, Alex Newman. We have a very special guest joining us today. We have talked quite a bit here over the last year or two about the after-school Satan clubs. Yeah, true story. And we have with us today Moises Esteves. He is the Executive Vice President of the Child Evangelism Fellowship. This is a group that sets up kind of after-school Bible clubs for students. They're doing great work across the country. And actually, the Satanists and their after-school Satan clubs were kind of a response to these Bible clubs. Moises, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us. Before we get into the Satanist clubs, talk a little bit about what you guys are doing across the country with these after-school programs for children to learn about the Bible and God.
Sure. Child Evangelism Fellowship has been in existence since 37, so about 86 years. We have many ministries, and one of our core ministries is what we call the Good News Club. That happens once a week during the school year. And it gives the children the opportunity to hear a Bible lesson. They learn songs. There's games. There's also a mission story. They learn about prayer. And, you know, they learn about the Lord and creative, fun ways. And we hold these clubs in a variety of locations wherever children are found. We obviously love working with local churches and help them minister to children in their church, because our heart is turned to the unchurched child for the most part. And so we hold clubs in a variety of locations. And one of our preferred locations is the public school. That's where the children are, and that's where we want to minister to them. So we've had these clubs for a long, long time. And in 2001, the United States Supreme Court made a decision, a vote 6-3, that our clubs are constitutional to take place in the public schools and cannot be discriminated because of our content. And so that opened the doors even wider. And so thousands of locations, public schools across America, will be starting this fall once again with Good News Clubs, where children learn about God every week.
That's fantastic. And so the Satanists were not pleased. Lucian Graves has been setting up these after-school Satan clubs. We've talked about them quite a bit here at the New American Magazine. We've been reporting on what's going on there, but they are after you guys. In fact, you guys are the reason they got into the business of going to public schools. Talk to us a little bit about what's going on with the after-school Satan clubs and how they're coming after the Child Evangelism Fellowship that you guys are doing.
Yeah, that strategy started in 2016. So basically they select, they don't go to any school. They select a school that has a Good News Club. And so they come with great PR, trying to basically scare everybody that they're going to have this Satan club in the public school, to scare the community, the leaders in the school district, and so on, with the hopes that they're pushed out. And because that's their best strategy, is to get pushed out by the school district, because once they get pushed out, they basically use the same victory we had with the Supreme Court to say, wait a minute, you can't discriminate against us. And if you're going to push us out, you need to push out everybody. So therefore, if that happens, then they shut down shut down our Good News Club. So that's really their strategy. And they pursue public schools that have Good News Clubs taking place.
So how do you guys respond to that? I mean, you know, I've got my opinion. I think the Supreme Court was way out of line when they removed prayer and Bible out of the schools. I think that was a flagrant misinterpretation of what the First Amendment was actually designed to do. But, you know, that's what, unfortunately, most school districts are using as their policy. So what do you say when these after-school Satanists say, well, hey, if you're going to allow Christians to have after-school clubs, we want to be able to do our Satanist propaganda after school as well?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of ways to respond to it. Obviously, our biggest response is to focus on the message of the gospel and teach the children about God. And that's what we do. I'm reminded in, I believe, 2016, they erected in Boca Raton, Florida, 10-foot tall, 300-pound red pentagram that had the words in it, "May the children hail Satan," which is a statement that's quite telling. And in contrast, Good News Clubs teach children or give children the opportunity to learn about who God is, about his love for them, learn to sing worship songs to the Lord, which is very different than what they're trying to do with children. So we try that our message is much stronger and better. And we obviously have a great support from the parents. Actually, as a matter of fact, to attend a after-school Good News Club, children have to have parental permission slips turned in. And the response from the parents is fabulous. They're very, very encouraged. They want us to be there. They want their children to be a part of that weekly club. And they usually are the ones that turn down the child attending the Satan Club.
So in an ideal world, what do you think should be happening here? I mean, do you think the schools ought to be tolerating after school Satan clubs? I mean, if they tolerated a Good News Club, do you think that means they really need to have an after school Satan club there?
Yeah, if the school immediately pushes the Satan club out, there's a likelihood our club might be shut down as well. So we usually say the preferred strategy is let them in. Let them in, because actually, who shuts the club down is the parents, because of all the troubles kids are going through this day and age with, you know, drugs and gangs and online violence. I mean, the list goes on and on forever. The last thing a parent's going to do is sign a parental permission slip sending their child to a Satan club.
Moses, talk a little bit about what does an after-school club do? You said you present the gospel to the children. I mean, what does a normal Good News Club look like when you guys are involved?
Yeah, Good News Clubs are fantastic, and especially when they take place in the public school, because, you know, once the instruction time ends, then the Good News Club begins. And I mean, you'll be hearing in the hallways gospel songs. There will be a Bible lesson. The gospel is shared. An invitation for salvation is given to the children. They will also be learning about prayer and have an opportunity to pray in the club. There will be an activity, a game that reviews what they learned in the Bible lesson. Sometimes there's missions teaching. I mean, it's a packed, anywhere between an hour to an hour and a half, a high-powered Sunday school hour or session, and the kids just love it. And it's very transformational. We get stories all the time of lives being changed. I'll tell you one real quick. We'll be encouragement to you. We had two twin girls attending this Good News Club, and God began to impact their lives and change them. And because of their changed behavior and they changed lives, the parents started noticing at home the changes, and they ended up attending the church of the team teaching the Good News Club. Both parents got saved. Dad was an alcoholic, and God set him free from alcoholism. And there's a beautiful moment in which the family of four, so that's the two twin girls, mom and dad, all are baptized at the same time. So Good News Clubs are changing lives, families, communities, and churches are excited about planting that lighthouse of the gospel right in the middle of their community in the public school.
Fantastic. You know, there's been a lot of work on this by the people who oppose Christianity. In fact, you know, one of the things that I've done throughout my career is look at the history of the public school system. And, you know, one of the guys who is really more responsible than anybody for setting up the public school system in America today, John Dewey, is almost universally recognized as the founding father of our public school system. He was the author of the Humanist Manifesto. And one of his colleagues who also signed this Humanist Manifesto, C.F. Potter, wrote in a book that public schools were going to become the most powerful allies of humanism. You know, there's nothing that a Sunday school 1 hour a week is going to be able to do to combat 5 days of humanistic teachings. And yet you think that these after school Good News Clubs, they're able to kind of counteract 5 days of teaching that really in many ways contradicts and even minimizes the Bible and biblical truth. I mean, you guys are finding success with that?
Absolutely. Listen, the power of the gospel cannot be underestimated. to change lives. And once kids come to faith in Christ, they begin to get a whole different perspective on life. And then the ongoing discipleship takes place as they learn God's word. And we always have truths for the saved child. How do they grow in their faith? And then we encourage them to attend the local church of the team that is teaching the Goodness Club, because we do this in partnership with local churches. And yes, and we see transformation taking place, because we're not just talking about filling the head with facts. We're talking about regeneration. The Holy Spirit comes to live inside of the child when they place their faith in Christ. And now you have the Holy Spirit with you, helping you. And it makes a complete difference. And so we have thousands and thousands of schools open for Goodness Clubs. And to be honest with you, what we need is more churches to partner with us, selecting a team so we can train them, and then we can send them into that public school, everything they need to have a successful Good News Club. And so we want to encourage people to be a part of that. Some people say, well, this is going on, that's going on in the country. But listen, the doors are open right now, today. I don't know how long they're going to be open, but today they're open in the public schools. And all we need to do is to step up, get the training, get the materials, and get started. And it's the most rewarding thing you can do with your time.
Fantastic, Moses. So these Satanists, the Satanic Temple, the people doing the after-school Satan clubs, they kind of downplay what they're doing. They're like, oh, we don't really actually believe in a real Satan. We're not really worshiping, the Prince of Darkness, the Prince of Demons. They kind of take a more, officially atheistic point of view here. But, the Bible does describe Satan as a real being, of course, a fallen angel. Do you believe what we're seeing here is really a confrontation between good and evil, between God and the Prince of Darkness?
Yes, I do believe. We believers know that if you're an atheist serving your master, you're serving the devil. If you're a Satanist serving your master, you're serving the devil. It's all the same thing. And, something very telling happened in Detroit in 2015 when they basically dedicated, unveiled this devilish statue creature, I think eight and a half feet tall, weighing 3,000 pounds. And what they did is for you to get a ticket to attend this ceremony, those people had to sell their souls to the devil. This is documented. Think about that, and think about the contrast of a Good News Club where the children will hear the gospel of Christ and will be given an opportunity to place their faith in Christ for salvation. What a difference that message is. And listen, we want to encourage people to go to cefonline.com, cefonline.com. We have a beautiful chapter finder because we have 400 offices in the USA. They can put their zip code, find out their local CEF office, and contact that local director and figure out how they can get involved, or even just sit in the back of the room and watch a Good News Club. It will transform your life to be part of this amazing work of God, which is to pass the knowledge of God to the next generation. There is no more important task you can do in this country.
Awesome, Moses. We are almost out of time, but what you're doing, I think, is just extraordinary. What would you say if you were talking to the Lucian Graves right now? I mean, what would you say to him about his efforts? I mean, what would you say to him about your efforts and about what's happening in our country and what's happening in the schools?
I've had the opportunity to do that in some interviews in the past, since this has been going around since 2016. And he needs to get saved, number one. He needs to give his heart to Christ. And we've read the Bible. We know how the story ends. We know that it's God that wins and Satan is punished for eternity. So this is a lost cause for him and for his people. And God has a better message, because that whole atheism, Satanism thing is a hopeless thing. There's nothing beyond the death and a lot of hopelessness. What Christians present is a message of hope, strength, and encouragement that God provides today for the challenges we face as we live in this broken world, but also the hope of eternal life with Christ in heaven. The message of Christianity is a strong transformational message, and his message is a dead end.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, it's so obvious how much they hate the Bible. They just had the Satan Con in Boston, and right at the opening ceremony there, they just kind of went wild, ripping apart the Bible and shrieking. You know, it's very, very sad to see that, and I hope people will pray for these individuals. Moses, before we let you go, one more time, how can people find you guys, get in touch, even get involved?
Sure, cefonline.com. You can go there and find a CF office close to you. Get involved, you know, pray, donate, teach. We especially need all these clubs we do in public schools, we do in partnership with local churches. So go talk to your pastor and form a church, form a group in your church. We'll help you with everything you need. We'll take care of unlocking the public school for your club. We'll provide the literature, the training, the liability insurance, everything you can possibly think we'll provide. And you'll have the joy of planting this amazing lighthouse in the center of your community, because the public school is the center of the community. And you'll be able to every week teach the word of God. When the parents come and pick up the kids at the end of club, what a great opportunity to develop relationships, invite the whole family to church. I'm telling you, it's one of the most powerful ministries, outreach ministries that a local church can do.
Well, Moses, we thank you very much for what you're doing. Thank you for spending a little time with us today. Folks, go check it out. You know, these people, they really are up against the Satanic Temple, like literally in the truest sense of the term. And so I hope you'll check it out. Thanks again for watching. I'm Alex Newman. This is Conversations That Matter. Till next time, God bless you all.
All right, parents, listen up. We've all seen the countless examples of how radical leftists have been destroying American schools. It's no longer just about the terrible math and reading levels. Now radical left teachers birthed from liberal universities are forcing gender indoctrination in kindergarten. They're teaching lessons on white guilt.
Freedom Project Academy has perfected live online learning over the course of a decade. I get a ton of great feedback about this program, a ton.
They're built on Judeo-Christian values, a classical curriculum. What does that mean? It means they're taught, your children are taught the way that the founding generations of the country. My own son Noah did Freedom Project Academy for several years when he was younger.
The more we tell our friends about these things, the more people will get on board, and I believe that we can be the catalyst to some real change.
We must save the West. Our way of life and our culture is under attack, and because of patriots like you and your project, I have optimism for the future.
Well, to complete today's show, John Birch Society Research Project Manager Christian Gomez interviews constitutional expert and New American author Joe Wolverton about the full extent of the power an Article 5 convention would possess, should one be called. Such a convention is offered as means for reining in out-of-control government, but the results could be very different from what convention advocates claim.
This is Christian Gomez for the New American Magazine, and I'm joined today on the program with Joe Wolverton. Joe Wolverton is a contributor for the New American Magazine and author of various books about the Founding Fathers and James Madison. Joe, thank you for joining us today here on the show.
Thank you, Christian. I am proud to be with you.
So back on July 23rd, you wrote an article, a very good article, that everyone who's interested in the subject of an Article 5 convention should read and have in their toolkit, and that's the article entitled "The Convention of 1787, Gouverneur Morris Admits the Dangerous and Unspoken Truth of the Convention's Power." So let's get into that article. What is the unspoken truth that he admitted there at the convention?
Well, let me give you the sort of full freight of the message is that they, at that time in the end of July, the delegates reckoned that they were at the end or near the end, and they were discussing how they would get their proposed constitution approved, how to supersede the Articles of Confederation. And they were in two camps. One camp said, let's have the state legislatures do it. And the other camp said, no, let's have the people of the states do it. And Oliver Ellsworth of Connecticut, he says, I don't like the thought of having these conventions, he says, because they are better fitted to pull down than to build up constitutions. And he says it would cause, they always are the scenes of great confusion, he says. And then Gouverneur Morris stands up of New York and he says something that any sincere seeker of truth, anybody who wants to really follow and, you know, wants to follow the wisdom of the founders, he tells Oliver Ellsworth, Mr. Ellsworth, you erroneously suppose that we are proceeding on the basis of the Confederation. This convention is unknown to the Confederation. In other words, Mr. Ellsworth, you're wrongly supposing that it matters what Congress says or what the Articles of Confederation say. This convention is beyond the power of those things. And nobody refuted what he said, because, of course, at the time, all of this was said in secret. There was a secrecy rule. So he could say, you know, the quiet part out loud. He could say that, look, we all know that this convention here may have been called by Congress, but we're beyond the power of Congress to control. We're beyond the power of the Articles of Confederation to control. If you take that forward, there could be a Gouverneur Morris 2.0 at some sort of convention, and regardless of the rules, stand up and say, guess what, guys? The truth is, we're beyond the power of the state legislatures to control. We're beyond the power of the Constitution to control. And he could make an accurate statement saying the Constitution is silent on this aspect, that, and it is. And he could say, since we're beyond that, let's use this opportunity to really make some important changes to the Constitution. And that's the power that people don't like to talk about, is these conventions would be just like it was in 1787. Can you imagine the different levels of erudition, of virtue, between the men there in 1787 and whomever would be occupying those seats in a future convention? And Gouverneur Morris saying, hey, guess what, guys? No one can control what we do. And if we send it to the people and they approve it, who cares what Congress says? Who cares what the Articles of Confederation say?
That's
powerful.
It is powerful. It's pretty much right in line with what former Chief Justice Warren Burger said in a letter to Phyllis Schlafly, that the actions of the convention could not be muzzled, whether it's by Congress or the Supreme Court or the executive branch or the state legislatures. There's no way to control the convention once it starts. And that was exactly the case at the 1787 Philadelphia Convention. You had the convention that was recommended by Annapolis, the state's, I believe, beginning with Virginia, applied or called for this convention, and Congress approved that. They agreed to this convention as well. But all of the commissions and the resolution from Congress said that they were only tasked to make the federal government, to basically amend the Articles of Confederation. Not to write a new
right.
Constitution.
It was Alexander Hamilton of New York who actually proposed it in Congress. And you can go, I mean, anyone can go online and read. I think it's February 21st, 1787, where Congress lays out the authority of the convention, saying that their, and this is a direct quotation, their sole and express purpose, unquote, is to recommend to Congress amendments to the Articles of Confederation. That was it, sole and express. You couldn't be more limited than that. And yet, the very first day that a quorum was present in Philadelphia, they proposed the Virginia Plan, which completely threw out the Constitution at the time, what we call the Articles of Confederation. And so what makes people think that people in, you know, some future convention wouldn't do likewise? The people who stood up at the beginning of the convention in 1787 and said, Mr. Madison, Mr. Randolph, we can't even debate this. This is so far beyond what we're allowed to do. And Mr. Randolph said, well, let's just debate it. Let's use it as a guide. And they did. Now, yes, we were very fortunate that we had men like James Madison and George Washington in attendance. I challenge you to find a James Madison and George Washington in politics today. And these men were elected by their state legislatures. the money that corrupts government today, that same money will be funneled into corrupting a future convention. And so just as one day they had the Articles of Confederation and the next day they had an entirely new form of government, that should inform and instruct us of the danger of a convention.
So would you say then that the quote that you read earlier from Gouverneur Morris from July 23rd, 1787, from James Madison's notes on the debates in the Federal Convention of 1787, would you say that that quote from Morris is the smoking gun proof that this convention was what one could describe as a runaway convention, that we can go beyond the authority of the states and Congress because it's unknown to it, we're above that?
That is that's a perfect way to describe it in modern terms. It is the smoking gun. He says that the thing that surely they were all thinking, he says it out loud. And, you know, it is curious and noteworthy that Gouverneur Morris was then after about a month after that, he was tasked with putting the Constitution in the final form that we have now, which made some interesting changes that, since it was the last day, the next to last day, were not debated as they should have been, such as changing "we the people of" and then listing the states, changing that to "we the people," which Patrick Henry famously said, "Where did you get that authority? That's crazy." But Gouverneur Morris, here he is with a smoking gun, and then they put the pen in his hand and said, "You go ahead and write it in its final form." Well, you can imagine if he already said, "Well, we're beyond the power of Congress, beyond the power of the Constitution," that man, putting the pen in that man's hand, is a dangerous proposition.
And more dangerous to do that in today's modern day and age.
Precisely.
Well, Joel Wolverton, thank you again so much for your time coming on the show to discuss this quote from Governor Morris and the significance of that quote as it bears today with the current debate of whether or not we should have an Article 5 constitutional convention or a convention of states, as some call it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Christian. My pleasure.
Well, thank you for joining us today. And remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. We'll see you tomorrow.